Accession number 17826, Reel 5.
There's a very important factor here in keeping nose into wind all the time, isn't it?
Yes, I was going to touch on an experience that we had, and I'll come to that very shortly. That is known as intake momentum drag yaw, and it is of paramount importance. But I'll give you a bit of an example in a few minutes. The cockpit of our aeroplane at this time, cockpit instruments, really, I mean, the predominant features were two fuel gauges and a jet pipe temperature gauge and an RPM gauge. And when eventually those gauges were moved from in front of us to other parts of the aeroplane, we felt a little bit naked with it. But in the first instance, we could only hover for about 3 minutes without running out of fuel. Therefore, fuel was paramount importance to us. Well, it was quite difficult to make friends with this extraordinary-looking aeroplane with big bulbous metal intakes, stripped of 700 pounds of weight, including radio sets, generator, pitot head, undercarriage doors, and this thrust-to-weight ratio, which in theory allowed fuel for a maximum of 3 minutes hovering. And we operated from a gridded platform in the first instance. This was designed to take away the jet efflux. And if you imagine doing the exercise from a slab of concrete, one, the jets would have hit the ground and gone out sideways, recirculated hot air back into the intake, shot out sideways and provided suction and a lot of disturbance to the aeroplane. And in fact, we find that the performance of liftoff from solid ground compared with lifting off from a gridded platform where you've got no ground effects differs by about 500 or 600 pounds. So, I mean, that's quite a large amount of thrust to lose in those early days. Had we not used the gridded platform, we would certainly not have been able to get airborne. Well, the prototype P1127 XB831 and I seemed to build up a close relationship with each other right from the word go, despite the fire during the engine run. But the situation was made even more bizarre because I had been to Germany 1 month previously to demonstrate the Hunter at Landsberg to the German Air Force and was being driven back home when the driver drove me into a tree and I came round in hospital with a pops fracture, third degree of my ankle. It was plastered, but I managed to persuade the surgeon to allow me to bring my Hunter back to Dunsville. I was lifted up in a forklift truck into the cockpit, flew back to Dunsfold where the customs, immigration and an ambulance waited for me, whistled off to Halton Hospital to see that my leg had been set correctly, and there I was, with every possibility of losing the opportunity of flying an aircraft of a lifetime, because seldom does it come one's way to fly new prototypes and a new concept of this type. The brand new engine was something that any pilot worth his salt would want to fly. Well, I worked on the medical board. I hopped everywhere I could go. I flew everything dual I could fly, drove my car, and thanks to the good offices of the Royal Air Force Central Medical Board, I finished up with a medical category unique in aviation history, namely fit civil test pilot, tethered hovering only. Hawker Board of Directors gave me a reluctant approval, and so started a very exciting progress in my life. It was October the 21st, 1960, the anniversary of Trafalgar Day, significantly enough, that I stepped into the cockpit 17 months after we cut the first piece of metal and commenced the very first tethered hovering with tethers attached to the wing tip and nose, giving me just 1 foot of freedom in movement. Well, to our intense surprise and relief, the aeroplane lifted off and hovered. Well, it didn't prove much, because that was just the start, but it did prove at least that the thrust exceeded the weight, albeit when on the gridded platform. But on increasing the lengths of the tethers to 4 feet, we really were in trouble. We were cavorting around like a drunken cow, and sometimes rotating around the nose wheel, sometimes sliding sideways, and it really looked an impossible situation. There were, of course, dubious glances at my plastered ankle, and I knew it was nothing to do that, but other people thought to the contrary. Then we suddenly realized what the basic problem was, that the airplane had too much freedom in roll, and the gridded platform was sloping at about 1.5 degrees. So immediately we opened the throttle with the thrust vector pointing at the ground. The airplane rose even higher, leaned like a lame dog, and the horizontal component of thrust drove it sideways to the tethers. Situation was worsened too because periodically the airplane would rotate around the nose wheel. Well, the control power was quite inadequate to keep the wings level when once the thing had started sliding sideways. What we did was to put underneath each outrigger a small platform as a temporary solution. It became very apparent that that was the problem, and we were able to lift off. Then we put, designed on the back of an envelope, one night, on the airplane 2 days later, spring-loaded agricultural skids on the outrigger wheels, supported by bungee springs, so that we could have the aircraft laterally level at liftoff, despite the angle of the operational readiness platform that we were operating from. And we suddenly realized then that we had nailed the problem. Now, it's possible to hover the airplane with a measure of control, and we had the tethers instrumentated so they would tell us if we were pulling on a tether. We had to demonstrate to the resident technical officer of the ministry that we could hover within the confines of the tethering system before we were allowed to do free hovering. So it was for this reason that whenever we pulled on a tether, a light came on automatically and warned and showed ground observers that this would happen. Very quickly we got used to flying the machine within the hovers, and the day came to fly freely. My medical category was extended to free hovering not above 4 feet. Now, one thing that worried us was what would happen if we lifted off and got too high and ran out of fuel before we landed. We didn't have a radio on the aeroplane, so our chief flight development engineer, Fred Sutton, my life insurance policy for many, many years, stood with a green flag and a red flag. And if I got too high, he was going to wave the red flag at me. Well, it was with a freedom of like a bird out of a cage to get rid of the irritating restraints of the tethering system. And we did 2 1-minute hovers. And in that first month of flying, we had carried out a total of 21 flights. We were impressed very much by the serviceability of the aeroplane and the progress that we had made. At the end of that period, we grounded the aeroplane for until about March of the following year, when we got it ready to fly it like a normal aeroplane with the nozzles horizontal. That was due to take place at the Royal Aircraft Establishment, Bedford. Of course, by the time the aeroplane was ready for conventional flight, so was my ankle. So I had a full and normal medical category.
Can I quickly interrupt you for a clarification?
Yeah.
Presumably, the puffer system that you call it was operating all this time. The little air stabilization jets on the wingtips and so on. I mean, presumably, it is just not a stable machine without them.
Rather like what I mentioned,
yeah.
You have to imagine a brick supported by a fountain of air with no natural damping or stability. That's just what the aeroplane is. So it depends entirely on the puffer controls to maintain its attitude when you are hovering. Initially, those were constant demand puffers. They were always slightly open. Later on, in order to conserve engine power, we had them permanently shut until the pilot made a demand. By that way, we were able to keep the engine temperature down and give us added control power, because all the way along the line we wanted more power, we wanted more sensitivity, but if we'd had it all at the beginning, we'd have never hovered. So it was a compromise in the end. And we...
The air was fed from the fan, was it?
Or high pressure air from the high pressure side of the engine. So not from the pan, from the turbine of the engine.
Just ahead of the burners.
Mm. So it's pretty hot air that's coming out of there. Mm. Put your hand in the way to take it off. Mm. Very high velocity air is coming out of there. Very hot air too. So you can imagine the engineering that was involved in getting the necessary ducting through the fuselage of the aeroplane into the wingtips and so forth for that, and the overall engineering of the puffer controls and how they were constantly being updated, either from an engineering point of view or design point of view. I mean, for example, in Roll, we arranged for one bucket to blow up and the other to blow down, so we doubled the rolling moment, but it was at the expense of a bit of vertical thrust. And the control powers had to be increased, I think I'm right in saying, we'll come to that in a minute, about three or four times before they were adequate, because there are different demands that have to be made. Ground disturbance effects causes wings to go down unexpectedly. There's the problem you raise, rolling moment due to side slip. There's the problem of strengthening the yaw control to cope with this directional instability. There's the problem of the pitch control that has to cope with nose up pitch during a transition, or it has to cope with air bouncing on the ground, impinging on the tail and causing a strong nose down pitch. And of course you only know these things as you progressively experience them and realize what you've got to do about them. Then you've got to think of asymmetric stores. You get over the CG problem basically by carrying all the stores as near the CG as you properly can, because with this aeroplane you can't just think of the centre of gravity and the aerodynamic centre. You've got to think of the centre of thrust as well. If you move one, you affect the other two. Sure. So this has been one of the constraints and disciplines that has been imposed on us from
presumably the also with a twin spool engine, your throttle response is very good.
Well, a lot of people said, if you don't have these little light RB108 engines, very quick response, you'll never get away with the response on a big thing like Pegasus. I mean, it's interesting how we human beings can come out with bold statements like that without any knowledge of it. And this is exactly what was going on with the opposing camp from R.E. Bedford and Shorts. The response on the Pegasus was admirable for the V-style mode, because you're right at the top end of the RPM range anyway, you see.
Well, I remember them saying when the first Olympus came out that you could almost play tunes on the throttle.
Yes.
In comparison to the early ones, the single spool ones. Anyway, we're diverting.
Well, it was spring 96 that our first serious problem arose, and that's when we started.
Spring 76, was it?
If I said 76, I didn't mean that. I was mixing up 11, 27 and 61.
Oh.
So the spring of 61.
61.
And as we started taxiing and braking, and you see the 1127 had the wheels and brakes from a Seahawk. And when braking, we got this moderate main wheel judder. And to our surprise, with a sudden jolt, we snapped the main undercarriage off like a carrot. And the technical reason for this was due to the diametrically opposed brake pads producing a twice wheel speed excitation in bending and torsion. So all we did was replace the brake pads, and that destroyed that triggering off of the natural frequency. I remember that very well, because the Dunlop chap was there, a man called McLaren, and he'd organised bacon and egg sandwiches from us from the local pub, the Compasses. And by the time we came to eat them, we ate them cold and very sad.
Why were they asymmetric, the pads?
I mean, well, they weren't. They were diametrically opposite each other, but they triggered off. It was such that it triggered off the natural frequency of the undercarriage, and by making them not diametrically opposite, it broke up the resonant frequency. Then our next problem was uncontrollable nose wheel steering, and this was because we'd handed it over to the experts at Armstrong Whitworths, who had produced the Argosy Transport. So we used the system on the Argosy. The only difference was that the Argosy had a separate tiller control, whereas we controlled the aeroplane with a nose wheel steering button and the rudder pedals. And the other thing was that the P1127 weighed The Argosy weighed five times the weight of the P1127, carried only 10% of the weight on the nose wheel, whilst we had 30% of the weight of the aircraft on the nose wheel. So we weren't comparing like with like. We got an erratic degree of directional control by blipping and kicking rudder. I mentioned to you earlier on that by popping the nozzles down for a takeoff, we could steer the aeroplane on the jet reaction control system. Then in the fullness of time, it was said that the slotted link vernier, which we took out of the height control, was put into the rudder, nose wheel steering control, so that about the middle we had low sensitivity, and for large deflections of the rudder we had high sensitivity. Integrated with that at a later stage, we also had a self-shortening undercarriage, so the aeroplane didn't have this problem of freedom in roll, and it really had the handling characteristics of a superb Grand Prix motor car. So I think we finished up really with probably some of the best nose wheel steering and ground handling characteristics that you would wish for on any aeroplane. I mean, these things didn't happen quickly, they happened progressively. I mean, this latter thing took probably when the Harrier came along, it was incorporated. That's John Fossard got involved in that side of things. I'll touch on his name later. Well, there was a gap of 5 months since the initial hovering. We went to the Royal Aircraft Establishment at Bedford, the biggest, longest runway in a nice, quiet part of the country. And during this period, they'd done all the resonance testing and system tests prior to conventional flying. And this coincided with my ankle getting a clean bill of health. Well, the first major problem we ran into had been predicted by a very experienced operator, namely the bloke who pushed the tea trolley in the experimental hangar. He said, "You're going to have trouble with shimmy on those outriggers." I know, I've had it myself. And how right he was. At 150 knots, all hell was let loose. There was a noise like a cannon going off in the cockpit, terminating with an impressive bang as the tower burst, and along Bedford's runway we left a 1,000-metre black squiggle, 1.5 cycles per second of an amplitude of 18 inches. Just felt as if the aeroplane was falling apart when this lot happened. And the interesting thing was the undercarriage manufacturer said, "That's not classic shimmy, we've tested it up to 200 knots on our ground rig." Well, I mean, that may be so. The basic problem was that when you were snarling along the runway, the wheels were not in firm contact with the ground, so there were, one moment there was damping there to damp the oscillation out, the next moment there wasn't. So what we did, we put shear pins in, locked the outriggers fore and aft, and then accepted that if you did a sideways landing, you'd shear the shear pin. And later on we had inward castering only, and that problem, together with the self-shortening undercarriage leg and the new nose wheel steering, really revolutionised the aeroplane. Well, at RAE Bedford, we had our work. It was a marvellous experience from me. I mean, you couldn't really talk about halcyon days. I had a rapide to go around the local area and for communications purposes, a Hunter for practice flying, a brand new XK120 motor car, and the superb prototype. Well, I mean, what more could you wish for than that? Really, it was terrific. Well, over and above the glamour of it, we had to make sure we were doing the job properly.
Did the XK120 contribute to the Harrier program?
Well, it didn't write me off, that was for sure. We thought a lot about how we were going to do it, and obviously we wanted to do it successfully, and the preparation you put into a thing like this is extremely important. Again, part of your life insurance policy. You owe it to the company and yourself and everybody else when you're put in that position of responsibility to make sure no stone is left unturned. So we simulated everything we could in the Hunter, from engine failure on takeoffs, streaming the parachute, calling for the barrier, operating at the same fuel state for the same duration as the 1127 would do, leaving the undercarriage down till we were at an altitude of 500 feet in case there was some phenomenal trim change, restricting the amount of throttle movement that we ran into so there was no risk of N over root theta top end surges and move the throttle very carefully to give everything the best possible chance of getting that aeroplane airborne safely with very modest targets to go for.
In the sort of English way of saying N over theta top end surges.
Yes, to minimise the possibility of getting surges which can be a function of the fan RPM outside air temperature, and of course to that you have to add aircraft incidents as well. This is the sort of thing that you have to know about on an engine, so you know how the engine's got to be screwed down or the intake later on has got to be adjusted to cater for it. Mixed up with that, of course, there's also the gun firing one, which we'll come to on another occasion. We gave ourselves a speed of 450 knots and 4G, and just took our time very quietly. There was the usual abundance of adrenaline in the cockpit as one came to take off. No great surprises. The aeroplane was tremendously lively in roll, had an exhilarating thrust-to-weight ratio. But it had so very much wrong with it. I mean, although after landing, the public relations department said, chief test pilot says she handled beautifully and has a great potential. That really meant a great potential for a test pilot school because it had everything wrong with it. I mean, it tightened up in turns. It pitched up. It had a transonic wing drop. It had an excessive nose-down trim change with landing flap and... It had a noisy vibratory ride, it had zero static stability in pitch, and it had premature buffet onset in manoeuvre. And so when we came to do the landing on it, I chose to do a flapless landing, so we didn't have this problem of having to hold an outer trim force on the final approach, and having landed one, streamed the parachute, and everything was quite satisfactory. But the engine limitations that we had to observe on the flight, I mean, I'll just give you a feeling for them. We marked the gauges to minimize the difficulty in doing it, but we had to avoid 43-54% fan RPM, avoid 69-77% fan RPM, don't throttle back below 77% RPM above 0.7 Mach number, and then the same below 54% fan RPM above 0.5, limit the throttle, opening to avoid top-end surge. And frequently we had a deceleration flame-out on landing, and we always had an engine fare on shutdown. And these are the classic constraints that you get often when you're flying a new prototype aeroplane. This one was no exception. But we did a number of flights, and we felt there was nothing that would stop us from slowing down below the stall to look at the approach to a transition. The aim being, have a conventional aeroplane that you slow down to 90 knots, a hovering aeroplane that you accelerate from the hover to 90 knots. The bridge is gapped, look at the results, is everything okay? One thing I haven't touched on at the moment is the intakes. If you want high efficiency of intake on a V-style aeroplane, the intake wants to be bulbous. And that is not compatible with high-speed flight. It was always envisaged that we would have a pneumatic intake that blew up to provide high static efficiency and hovering efficiency, sucked down to a sharp intake for high-speed flight. This was not ready at the time, so we started off with a bulbous metal intake, speed limited to 250 knots, and that's for hovering and low speed. And then when we came to fly the airplane conventionally, it had a sharp intake for high-speed flight, but no good for hovering. So that's another classic example of having to wait for development to catch up before you've got all the features incorporated in one aeroplane. We have the pleasure, and sometime I'll show you the slides, perhaps when I'm giving a talk you might like to see it. Sydney Cam came along. There's a nice picture of Sydney Cam at R.E. Bedford, having a look at the aeroplane and having a chat. Nice picture of Stanley Hooker. Well, over a period of time, some years, to achieve the standard that we have today, we had to, one, re-engineer the nozzle control box, which I mentioned. elimination, we had actually a number of serrations. We'd move the lever sideways and it would engage with the slot. Well, you could never engage with the right slot. So all that lot went out and we just had a hover stop. We came straight back to the hover stop. And if we wanted an intermediate position, we just selected the intermediate position. And then you lifted it back to come to the braking position. The extravagant constant bleed system was replaced by a total demand variable bleed system in which the valves were shut until you needed to make a demand. The roll sensitivity, the gearing from the stick to the reaction controls in roll, was increased 5 times to a figure of 0.75 radians per second squared per inch of stick deflection. We increased the roll control power 4 times, finishing up with a figure of 2.4 radians per second squared. So, I mean, all these, the roll power went up from a figure of only 0.6 radians per second squared to a figure of 3.5 radians per second squared. So you see, all these things were getting progressive overhauling. And the control in yaw was increased 3.5 times from 0.1 radians per second squared to 0.35 radians per second squared. The yaw proved to be a very important aspect of the aeroplane, such that we provided a separate yaw control. And during our very early hovering trials, intake momentum drag yaw introduced itself unexpectedly to us. Its effect was minimized. Initially, we increased the control powers and maintained a very close discipline regarding combinations of side slip, incidence, and airspeed. And latterly, we put in pedal shakers that vibrated the rudder pedal and told the pilot immediately which rudder should be applied to suppress side slip, because it was natural to apply the correct aileron to suppress a wing drop, but unnatural instinctively to put on the right rudder to suppress the side slip to get down to the root of the trouble. Now, examples of what went on were on the following lines. One day, Executive Director Bob Lickley arrived on the scene saying, "I'm bringing Air Chief Marshal McGregor, CNC Fighter Command, along to see you fly today." And I said, "Well, have a care, because we're doing something we've never done before. We should be moving forward about 30 or 40 knots, 40 knots and doing a turn." Well, it didn't sound anything very dramatic. Well, Bob Lickley decided that we'd bring the CNC Fighter Command along anyway, and he came, and I started this manoeuvre, and the aeroplane appeared to go on pirouetting as if in a flat spin, failing to respond to full opposite rudder, and eventually it came out, and I limped my way in the hover, one wing down, and put the aeroplane on the ground with a great sigh of relief. That was our first introduction to this phenomenon. Then suddenly everybody discovered what it was. Intake momentum drag yaw. And this became known, this incident became known in history as the McGregor turn, after Air Chief Marshal McGregor. Basically what it is that a normal aeroplane has a fin on the back to keep it straight directionally. But the fin is not effective until you are doing about 90 to 100 knots. With the P1127, the aeroplane is unstable directionally, and when you get side slip on, you are destroying the momentum of a large mass of air, and the aircraft wants to yaw nose downwind, because there's no restraining force of the directional static stability from the rudder to keep the aeroplane straight. Now, from 0 to 30 knots, it's not over important, because you're not getting very strong aerodynamic effects in roll as well. But above that, you suddenly find that there are very strong rolling moments associated with the side slip, right outside the control of the aileron jet reaction control system on the aeroplane. So it was for this reason that we had to go to devices instill in the pilot the importance of keeping the aeroplane pointing into wind with a side slip indicator